That's okay.
This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing the oral history interview with Captain Robert Rankin. What is today's date?
It's June 2nd.
Thanks.
June 2nd.
Thanks, Mike. 2004. I'm in the interview room in the Special Collections Building on the campus of Texas Tech, and Mike is joining me by telephone from the Washington, D.C. area. Mike, obviously, we've already been talking, and I wonder if you can just review for me the kinds of positions that you were looking at in 1968 when you were looking for a job.
Yes, I was in my last year of psychiatric residency in Chicago at Presbyterian St. Luke's Hospital, Rush Medical School. And I was wanting to go to the West Coast, but not quite sure where, but I did know I wanted to do community psychiatry. I didn't want to do private practice. I wanted to be in a community mental health center or a public facility of some sort. I had done some of that in my training at the Miles Square Center in Chicago, working out in a mental health center, a public health center for low-income residents, and I liked that. I felt I was good at it, and that's what I really wanted to do. So I did this. I set myself up interviews, wanting to be on the West Coast with programs in Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, Menlo Park, Los Angeles, and San Diego, I think. I may have gone down to San Diego. I don't remember whether I actually did or not. But in any case, I interviewed in all of these places. When I was finishing up with the Navy in 1966, I had lived in San Pedro in Southern California near Los Angeles,
right,
and had rented a little house there right on the ocean that I really liked, and my thought was probably I would want to go back there. But I wanted to look in Seattle and Portland and so forth also. As it turned out, the interviews were all good, and I liked a lot of the programs, but I did decide to go to Los Angeles County Mental Health and asked to be assigned down in San Pedro, Wilmington, Long Beach area. And that's what I did. I took that job starting in July of 1969 and was able to maintain my Navy Reserve commitment there in Long Beach, which is the port from which I had left to go to Vietnam.
And what unit were you able to get a posting with?
I was with the Navy Reserve Center there. I don't think they put me on ships right away. And I had not had a lot of experience in reserve centers on shore, and I didn't particularly like it. So I told them, you know, if you can find me some ships to sail on, I'll stay in the Navy. If you can't, I'm probably going to get out. And I think probably there were some destroyers coming in. I would do TAD work with some of the destroyers that were a little short on their docks, or the docks would be on vacation, and I would just go over the ships and cover for them, and we would go in and out a couple. You know, we might go up as far as Monterey or down to San Diego, but my basic work was right there in Long Beach.
Were you working with others who had already been over in Vietnam?
Not originally.
Okay.
No, this was that came later. I was not working. I was working mainly with African American, Hispanic, and low income white folks
in
the community mental health centers
okay.
there in San Pedro, Wilmington, which was beginning to get a very large Hispanic population, and Long Beach, which had a lot of retirees and which was giving me a chance to work not only with retired military, who seemed to like to come in and talk to someone who had a military experience, but also my first experience in working with older people, very much older people. And Long Beach at the time was considered a little Iowa. a lot of Midwesterners came out and settled there, and it was the place they wanted to be, you know. And so it was a real chance to do geriatric psychiatry, which I hadn't had before, and I found I really enjoyed that too.
And with the younger people from a broad demographic representation there, what kinds of things were you seeing?
I was seeing a lot of things. I was seeing the general, severe mental illness, both the mood disorders and schizophrenia, usually start in the 20s.
Okay.
And I was seeing a lot of kids who were beginning to have those problems. I was seeing a number of people who had severe substance abuse problems who were from more up near the northern part of Los Angeles, the Hollywood area, including some who were kids of some of the movie moguls and stars, because they didn't want their kids treated up there where the neighbors could know about it.
How did they get into the county system?
All they had to do was to come down and interview. We had no means test. I mean, if they would come down and apply for services, we would accept them. We didn't. We were pretty flexible about that.
So that's an area that's changed quite a bit.
It certainly has.
Okay. Which is the superior system in your view, Mike? Somebody a system that welcomes basically all comers who have some kind of residential qualification, or the much more restricted access system?
Oh, the all-comers, by far. Absolutely. No question. I mean, we treated the problems. We didn't treat the geography, and we didn't treat, if we had someone who was clearly wealthy, there was kind of an understanding that they would contribute in some way to the treatment, even if it meant buying books for our little patient library or something, giving something back. The way I got into that connection up in Hollywood was very, very strange. You want to hear about that?
Absolutely, yes,
okay.
Please.
Okay. I was looking for a house to buy down there, and I had a realtor, and she was showing me around, and she said something about my southern accent. Where are you from? And I said, I'm from Lake Village, Arkansas. And she said, won't believe this. I grew up in Parkdale, which is about 20 miles from Lake Village.
Isn't that funny?
And we knew a lot of the same people. Uh-huh. And she said, Rankin, was your dad James Rankin? And I said, yes. And she said, I used to date your dad. Well, it got stranger. This woman's daughter was Sally Kellerman.
Oh,
and
you're kidding.
Sally had just made a huge hit in MASH, and she said, are you single? And I said, yes. And she said, my daughter is, too. You want to date her? And I said, well, this was not a time to come out to the woman, I didn't think.
True.
So I said, well, I really admire her work. Why don't we all have dinner one night? And so she invited me over for dinner, and this woman was looking for someone very, very different from me, Sally Kellerman. But anyway, we sort of hit it off, and we began to talk. We didn't date, obviously, but we got together a few more times. And she knew someone who had a daughter who was having major drug problems, and she said, I can't get her to take her in to anyone because she's scared to death about the neighbors. Could you see her down in your clinic down there? And I said, sure. So I did, and after that, the word sort of got out. This is a place where your kids can get good treatment, and the neighbors won't know about it in Hollywood and all of that. And that's how that happened.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
What was your impression of Sally Kellerman, just as a person? What was
I liked her.
Take on her?
Yeah, I liked her very much. I mean, if I'd been heterosexual, I'm sure I would have been delighted to date her. she was looking for, someone much more connected to the movie community and all of that. But I think I was kind of a relief to her a little bit to talk with someone or be with someone who had not a clue about what that world was like had a very different world and a different experience. And we talked about MASH, and we talked about my war experiences and all that, so we had that in common.
Was she interested in
what you were saying? Yeah, she was. She was. And she said, what do you think about what we're doing on MASH? And I said, I love it. I think it's great. It wasn't exactly what we experienced in Vietnam, but it was certainly wonderful to see.
Did she express any view on Vietnam? Did you discuss the
war? Yeah. I had, by that time, I was beginning to get involved in the in the anti-war movement, and she said, good for you. If I can help in any way, let me know. And I said, well, we may ask you to speak sometime. I never actually, by that time, I think the, whatever, if you can call it a relationship, our connection was beginning to wind down, so I didn't ever have a chance to ask her to do that. But she did volunteer to.
That's interesting.
And she may have done it. If she did, I'm not aware of it.
Mm-hmm. So. But she may have pursued that in some other.
She may have, form. Yeah. But no, she was. This was 69 and 70, and by then the anti-war movement was just going full blast. I do know that she was just disgusted with Nixon, and as of course was I, and so we had that in common too.
Mm-hmm.
I liked her very much. I've had no contact with her since 1970, but
sure. But it's an interesting. Brush with greatness, I guess they call it.
I guess
BWG.
Which came from a woman who dated my dad, which is very strange.
That's great. I like the Arkansas connection.
I do, too.
That small town thing.
Well, unfortunately, dad had died by then, so I couldn't say, hey, who I met back here in California?
Yeah, guess who
who I met. Yeah. Was this before you met mother or after?
That's right. Would he have enjoyed that?
He'd have loved it. He would have loved it.
That's good.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds as if it was very interesting and also fruitful for a number of people who, were sort of in the Hollywood scene in some way, but who needed some help. And in that, what must be a fairly claustrophobic and confining, although, from the point of view of, the little people, I guess, we always think Hollywood and all that must be some kind of, dream existence, but I'm sure that what you saw was the underside of all of that.
I did.
And about can you give any sense of how many times that network sort of brought a patient your way?
Oh, let's see. I was at Long Beach there until about for about 5 years, I think, somewhere around in there, back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
I would say probably about 20 times. If you're talking about someone from the movie industry sending one of their kids down to be treated, I'd say about 20 times.
And it tended mostly to be young people?
Tended to be young people, late teens, early 20s, and it tended to be more drug-related than anything else. Although there were a couple that were having drug problems because they were beginning to get major mood disorders, major depression and all that. And
right. In other words, one could lead to the other.
They were self-medicating.
Exactly.
And some of the parents were almost relieved to find out that this is what the issue was. It wasn't just the drugs. They saw it as a rationalization for taking the drugs, and I had to talk to them about how that works in treatment and all this. But, there were about 20 or so. And there were a couple in which case they were not the children. They were the partners, where they would send a partner who was having drug problems, and both men and women, and worked with them too. They all said, can you see me? You know, I don't want to come down. I'm well known. People will recognize me. Can you see me in the evening if I want to come down and have a family conference with you and all of that? And I did some of that and some on the weekends. I respected that. But that was also true in Long Beach. I mean, we had a few politicians there and so forth who had their kids in treatment, and they too said, look, can we come in the evening? Can we come when the clinic is not full of patients in the waiting room so we can talk? And as long as it was a good reason, they were having family conferences and being part of the therapy, that was fine.
Okay, and so you made that possible for them.
Oh yeah.
That kind of flexibility, I'm sure, was that and just your willingness to see them was probably very much appreciated. Although I don't know how much that could be expressed at the time.
Yeah, it was a difficult situation. It was a difficult situation, but my staff respected that too, and some of them were part of the treatment team, and we all did that.
Mike. This time period that we're talking about, the end of 69 and then into the early 1970s, was, of course, a period in which street drugs, you know, sort of really took off in this country. And I'm sure that you were seeing some of the fallout from that. What kind of treatment plan, can you contrast the treatment plans of that time period with ones that might be the standard protocol now? I mean, how have things changed at all?
Well, they have. We had almost no medications that we could use at all, and we had an inpatient system that we could use, and that was absolutely necessary for detox. The idea was to get them clean and sober first, and then once we did that, we could do the talking therapy, I don't know that it is that different now. I think we certainly have, to the extent that the drug use was associated with depression, we have much better antidepressants now than we had then. To the extent that it was associated with schizophrenia, much better meds for schizophrenia. But in actual, the drug treatment, the drugs are very, very different now. I mean, we had very little cocaine, and LSD and all of that was a big thing back then.
Right.
And, those kinds of
psychedelics,
all of that. We had some amphetamine use, not a whole lot, a lot of grass, and that was, tried not to make that a big issue, but for some people it was. So it's kind of different now. But
what about the inpatient detox part that you mentioned? How accessible was a bed to put someone in?
Much more so than it is now.
This was the county hospital.
Yeah, the county hospitals. We had we used a number of the county hospitals and the state hospitals both. We had a nice connection with both.
Okay.
And so we were able to do that. I don't remember having to worry much about a waiting list. I remember when I needed to get someone in, I would call the doc on the unit and just say, Charlie's coming. I need to get him in. This is what he's using. We'll get someone to take him over there. Let me know when you get through and get him cleaned up, and we'll take it from there. We had a nice ongoing relationship with the hospital staff.
And issues like what insurance they had or how much their copay was or whatever?
It was irrelevant.
It just didn't even come up.
Didn't matter, no.
What state hospitals were you using?
We were using Napa State Hospital. We were using Metropolitan State Hospital in Southern California. Napa was up north.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly Metropolitan and Camarillo were the ones we were using. I haven't seen those in so long. I assume they're still in existence. But then when they began to close the state hospitals, when Reagan got in, they had a massive change there and closed a lot of the state hospitals or shut most of the units down, and the idea was to take care of these folks in the community.
Mm-hmm.
But the funding didn't come to the community to do it, and certainly the funding for housing and all of that didn't come. So here we all of a sudden began to have a huge cohort of street people and people who had, yes, been doing very, very well for 25 or 30 years in the state hospital, and they were saying they were warehoused, but in fact, to a considerable extent, the state hospitals were asylums. They were mostly out in the country. They were people, could easily visit with their families. It was a good system that was flawed. The staff was not nearly enough. Often the staff was not well enough trained. But there were places where these folks could go and have a decent quality of life. And then all of a sudden they begin to be constricted and shut down, or mostly shut down, and we have to take care of the community, and we didn't have the resources.
So the shift that happened during the Reagan administration was, as you've outlined, that patients were to be deinstitutionalized. The institutions themselves were to be more or less pared down in terms of numbers and staff. And money was supposed to flow to community
initiatives? To the communities, to the counties and the cities,
okay.
And it didn't.
So that there would be group homes or that kind of thing?
There were supposed to be, but there really were very, very few, and the ones we had were had very low quality.
So people who were functional but had, minimal job skills or whatever were pretty much having to find their own way?
They were, and the voc rehab programs we had were the best we could do, but we just didn't have the funds for enough of them. It really got much worse in 71, 72, 73. It really began to be just much, much worse than it had been.
So by Reagan administration, of course, at this point we're talking about the governorship.
That's right.
And I'll just skip forward a little bit, Mike, when he was elected president, or actually when he was running for president, did you have some concerns that this kind of thing might be pushed forward on the national agenda?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We all did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We all did.
Yeah. And let me ask you a little bit about the political climate in Southern California at the time you were there. You mentioned that of course, late 69 and then into the early 1970s, the anti-war movement was beginning to grow. What connection did you have to it, Mike? Was it intellectual or was it active?
It was active in terms of being a public speaker.
Okay.
And I had to be very, very clear that I was speaking for myself and not at all for the city of Long Beach or for the state of California or for the Navy or anything else.
Uh-huh.
I hadn't thought much about this, but I did a lot of that, and nobody in my Navy Reserve unit either they didn't hear about it, didn't know about it, or they didn't comment on it. I remember most of what I was doing was at UCLA and at USC, and boy, was that a disaster.
How's that?
UCLA was fine. USC was not fine. And I had some connections with the vets who were doing that, and they would say, would you come up and speak? You're a doc. You have a certain perspective from what your experience was over there that some of us don't have.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they'll listen to you in a way they won't listen to us. But I always made sure that when I spoke, the vets who were not docs were there with me. And I remember speaking at UCLA and talking just about my experiences over there and what it was like trying to take care of these kids and how painful it was to see them go and to see them die and to see them wounded, and getting a very understanding, very sympathetic, very supportive response. How can we help? Let's do that.
From whom?
From
the
students.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That I was talking to.
Mm-hmm.
And then they asked me to do it at USC. And then, we used to laughingly call it the University of Spoiled Children. Well, that was certainly proven true there. I got a very different response.
Really?
Oh, yes.
How
I mean,
so? What do you remember about it?
What I remember about it was, they didn't exactly call me a traitor, but it was close to that. I mean, it was a lot of challenges. I would be trying to talk to a group, and hecklers would come in and support our troops in Vietnam. You're undermining them with all this stuff and all that. And what a contrast that was to what I'd experienced at UCLA. In fact, I just told them, hey, I don't have much time. I'll do it. Anything I can do for you, but please send me to UCLA again. Don't send me back to USC.
Now, were you working with a specific group?
Yeah, no, that's against the war.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
both the formal official group and an informal group of vets who just among ourselves just said, hey, we got a chance to go up and talk. Let's go talk.
How did you sort of hook up with these guys? Do you remember?
I don't remember the specific names. What I do remember is there were a couple I had served with over there that I reconnected with when I got into Long Beach, when I came back from my training in Chicago. There were some who had settled in Southern California, and either I found them or they found me, and I don't remember whether I saw a report of what they were doing in the paper and tried to connect with them that way. I honestly don't remember, Laura, how that connection was made.
Okay.
But somehow they found me or I found them.
So did you speak more than just the two times that you've talked about?
Oh, yeah.
What other kinds of venues or events?
I spoke at the American Psychiatric Association meetings once, and I spoke, oh, boy, that was a powerful one. We were having a meeting. For the life of me, I cannot remember where it was. I think New Orleans, but I may be wrong, but I remember it was when they bombed Cambodia. And I was scheduled to speak on something pretty benign like PTSD or something like that. And all of a sudden, the chair of the panel jumped up and said, I want this association to condemn this action, and I'm going to shift the whole focus of this discussion from the clinical aspects of PTSD to how we can stop this horrible war.
Wow.
And I was one of the little panelists. And he said, I've invited a number of people to speak on this issue. I know they know what they're talking about academically. I want someone who's been there to talk about it. And there were two of us who had actually served in Vietnam.
Right.
And the other guy went first, and then I told about my experiences. So I know I did that.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And then,
what was the response in the room? Do you remember?
It was overwhelmingly positive. Absolutely. I mean, I don't know how much you remember about what the reaction was when we bombed Cambodia, but it was just astonishing.
Well, I, for example, know that some National Guardsmen in Ohio got a little trigger happy at Kent State.
That's exactly when that was.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And all of that had happened, and here we are having our meeting. And, boy, what shifted from it shifted from a purely clinical academic discussion of PTSD to the real world.
That's really amazing.
Yeah.
What kinds of things did you say, Mike? I don't know if you can recall this or not. You probably have just an impression of what
happened. Well, he said, I remember the chair of the panel, and I cannot remember his name. I mean, it's probably in some old archives from American Psychiatric.
Oh, sure.
But I remember his saying both to the other person.
I think it
was Jimmy, but I'm not sure. I've forgotten who the other person was. But anyway, he said to both of us, he said, you have the academic background to talk about your work with patients. That's fine. We have a lot of people who can talk about that. Tell us about what your life. Tell us about what it was like in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And we ran over in time. We had an hour, I think, for the presentation. We went nearly two, and he just had us talk. And we both just shared the experiences I've shared with you, and it was amazing. It was such a powerful moment.
Absolutely.
And thank God for the chair of the panel. I mean, he just shifted it to what everybody in that room wanted to hear what was being said. Nobody said, oh, I'm angry because I came for the academics. What new medicines are you going to tell me about?
Mm-hmm.
He said, you can get all of that from the they'll give you copies of their papers.
Yeah, the abstracts are in the back of the room. The abstracts of the papers are
in the
back
of the room. That's right, exactly. Read that. Now let's hear the real world.
Yeah.
And let's hear what's going to happen from this Cambodia bombing and the Kent State and all that. Yeah.
Wow. What do you remember about your own hearing of the Kent State disaster? Do you remember?
I remember being just stunned. I just couldn't believe it. And the picture of the young woman was in every newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And how can this have happened? How can we have gotten to this point? You know, Johnson said when Walter Cronkite turned against him, he knew he'd lost the country on the Vietnam issue. I think if there were any still supporting the war, I know a lot still supported it even after that, but certainly that was a powerful moment in the history of the anti-war movement.
Yes,
we all thought that, but I was so primed to think it. It's not surprising that I had that reaction,
right?
But a lot of people did.
I wonder, Mike, if you heard about the shootings that happened, I don't, I think it may have been a week later, in Mississippi at an African-American, a historically black college.
Yes, Jackson State.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah.
Did you hear about that
at
all?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. My family, in Mississippi.
That's what I, uh-huh.
Yeah, and of course I heard about it, absolutely. I would have heard about it anyway, but I certainly heard about it, and, you know, I was talking to the family about it, and they were as shocked about it as I was. Yeah, I definitely heard about it.
Wow. I mean, this was such a, as you have said, a cardinal moment in, I think, American thinking about the conflict and what it had brought the United States to domestically.
Domestically.
Let alone what was actually happening on the ground in Vietnam.
Sure.
Extremely difficult time. And I wonder, Mike, if this was, if this had any kind of catalytic effect on your thinking about what you wanted to do. I know that it was almost 2 years later, but you must have at some point started to think about the Peace Corps.
It probably is the time I started thinking what I'm doing here in Long Beach is good stuff.
Absolutely.
It's not. A lot of people can do this. I need to do something different. I really need to get out of here. I think I was thinking, this is just too intense. I'm getting depressed. I had a partner at the time, and it wasn't going well with him.
Uh-huh.
I was hard to be with.
Uh-huh.
It was just a time I needed to get away. And I was looking for something to do, and I thought, I even need to get out of the country. And so that's why I went to Peace Corps.
How did that opportunity present itself to you? Were you just kind of keeping your eyes open? And
nope. In Long Beach, they had an announcement in the newspaper that Peace Corps recruiter is going to be at this hotel.
No kidding.
On a Thursday afternoon or Thursday evening or something, anyone who might be interested in the Peace Corps, come and talk to us.
Well, I bet that recruiter was glad to see you walk in there.
Well,
with an MD, I'm sure they were.
Right. I said, when can I go? So that's when I signed up.
How much did you know about the Peace Corps at that point?
I knew a lot about it. I was just so admiring of it when it was founded, in 61, I think it was, with Sarge Schreiber. Founded it, and Hubert Humphrey had actually proposed it. He was the original proposer of it. As much as I like Kennedy, I think Humphrey didn't get enough credit for that.
I think you're probably right there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I had the greatest admiration for it. And I had actually wanted to do it even before this and had talked to my wife about it.
Uh-huh.
And she said, you know, I will never leave the country as long as my parents are living because they might need me. And that
she was very clear on a number of issues, wasn't she?
Yes, she was. She was, and so I said, okay, this is not the time to do it.
Okay.
But that was what my thinking was when I first came back from Vietnam, when I was still married, that, you know, would you go with me if we do something like this? I just need to get away from this.
Mm-hmm.
And she said no, and I wanted to keep the marriage, or thought I did,
sure.
going
mm-hmm.
for the time being anyway.
Right.
So I delayed it, but then there came a time when I couldn't. I delayed it about, what was it, about... more than 10 years, because I had come back in 67, 66, and I eventually went in 72, so I delayed it 6 years. But that had always been in the back of my mind anyway. I think I had thought about it even when I first heard about it in 61, I guess it was.
As a young man.
Yeah, but I was in med school then. I wasn't going to toss that aside. But and then the Navy called and all of that. But finally came a time when I did it.
How did it come about that you went to Ethiopia?
First, they were going to send me to the Ivory Coast, I think. No, it was Liberia. And they had a program there where they needed some docs. And for some reason, the program fell through. And they said, would you be willing to go to Ethiopia instead? Now, don't forget, I'm Jewish.
Yes.
And I knew about the Jews of Ethiopia,
mm-hmm.
The Beta Israel. We don't call them Falasha. That's the pejorative term,
yes,
which is the Amharic equivalent of nigger.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew about that, and I thought, well, boy, this will be a chance to do what they want me to do in Ethiopia, and also a chance to connect with that community. And I jumped at the chance to go to Ethiopia. They had me working with medical students out of the Haile Selassie University Medical School, taking them out into the rural provinces. We had a little housing and clinic and so forth about 200 miles west of Addis, and my job was to teach them to work with the native healers respectfully and to connect with them and make them allies in treating the rural population who were suspicious of doctors and medications.
Right.
And that was something I knew very well how to do, since I had done some of that in Vietnam, too. So that part of it worked very well. and then the rumblings of the revolution came, and eventually they got us out of there.
What about the language issues? How was that negotiated?
Well, that was not easy because there were so many of them. The Amharic is the language of the sort of educated upper classes, and that is the Semitic language. And my Hebrew is very minimal, but I knew enough Hebrew to be able to connect with that. Amhara means people of the mountains, both in Amharic, in Hebrew, and in Latin, and in Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
So I could connect a little bit with that, but where I was, they were not speaking Amharic at all. They were speaking Galenya and Shankila and several of the other languages, but Peace Corps gave me a language coach to be with me and to coach me and to teach me, and so I learned enough of it so that I could communicate with them.
Who was your coach?
A man named Otto Bolte. He was an Ethiopian who was hired by the Peace Corps precisely for that purpose. And he was a great guy.
What was his background? Can you tell me about him?
His background was about the equivalent of a junior college background.
Okay.
He had probably been in one of the American colleges or training programs or something there.
Sure.
And somehow got connected with Peace Corps.
Uh-huh.
He was wonderful. He was very sensitive to the, very respectful of all the various groups there. And I remember something very interesting that happened that gave me even more respect for Peace Corps. He said, you need to have a driver's license. You may have to drive the van around out there and go into the little, very rural areas and so forth. So we need to get you a driver's license. So we went to the office in Addis Ababa, where mm-hmm. I first met him, to get me a driver's license. And he said to the man at the window, this is a Peace Corps volunteer. He needs a driver's license. And he said it to him in Amharic or something. And the man's response, I'll never forget it, was, why are you speaking for him, if he's Peace Corps, he knows our language. And I thought that was such a respect for Peace Corps there that in the office just assumed that I would be speaking to him. And Otto Bolte said to him, well, he just got here, and he hasn't learned it yet. And the man said, oh, in that case, you know, okay.
Uh-huh.
But one thing they told us when we got over there, don't go anywhere near the American embassy. Do not use the stores and all of that the American embassy provides for you. You do not go to the commissary. You have no connection whatsoever with the American embassy, and we didn't. And, you know, it would have been cheaper, and it would have been nice to, we didn't even go to the embassy parties or anything like that. We just stayed strictly away from the embassy.
And what was the point of that?
The reason for that was that we wanted to be identified with Peace Corps and not with any particular American administration or policy or anything like that, and they assumed in Ethiopia, if you were part of the American embassy, you were CIA. And Johnson famously said at the beginning, he told Sergeant Schreiber, he said, when he was vice president, he said, I'm really going to support you on this, but you've got to be sure your people stay away from cuties, communists, and the CIA. That was the way he phrased it. Don't go over there and have them involved in any of that.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't. And that was very good advice Johnson gave.
Mm-hmm.
He was very clear on that. And when we got our little orientation, they said to us, there's an American embassy here, but don't go there. We have our own doctors. If you get sick, we'll take care of you. And they did. If you need something, we will provide it for you. We will provide everything. Don't go to the embassy. And don't date anyone in the embassy. And you wanted to hear another painful irony?
Yeah.
One of the reasons I think I'm HIV negative is because I'm gay. Virtually every male Peace Corps volunteer over there had a woman he was living with, and AIDS was just beginning to show up in Africa. I didn't have a woman I was living with, and I've known several who were heterosexual who were from that class of volunteers
mm-hmm.
who did become HIV positive, and I'm sure that's where they got infected.
It's from that very early...
From that very early time, and who knew in 72 or 73
nobody.
there was anything such as AIDS.
Right.
It was only
nobody, right? Mike?
Nobody, and it was a 10-year incubation period, and by the early 80s, people were beginning to get it and get symptoms of it, and they had picked it up in the 70s. And I remember I got a few questions. Hey, Doc, why aren't you, don't you have a girlfriend over here? And I didn't feel the need to go any further than that.
You just fielded it by kind of just turning it back?
Yeah, the same way I'd done it when I went on leave with my fellow officers and men in the Navy. Of course, then I had the excuse of being married, but
mm-hmm.
it wasn't a big issue.
And the relationship that you mentioned that you'd had in California, was that at an end at this point?
No, actually it wasn't. He was angry with me for leaving, but he said, we'll keep this going, and I gave him a tape recorder, and I had one, and we would send tapes back and forth and letters, and he would call about once a week. And so we really kind of maintained that, and then when I got back home, we tried again to make it work, but there were a lot of other issues there, too.
It just didn't. How would someone call you?
I was in Nkempe, Wallega Province, and that was it was a very rural little town, but it did have a main post office. It did have a main telephone center. Obviously, they didn't have phones in the houses.
Absolutely. Uh-huh.
So everybody who wanted to call went there to call. And I could make a call to him, or I could tell him, call me at a certain time,
right. And
I will be here to get your call. And I knew all the Ethiopians who ran it all, and they were, they knew we were doing good stuff out there, and they could not have been more helpful.
How large was the complement of Peace Corps volunteers in Ethiopia while you were there?
Oh, I would say, I'm not quite sure. I would say probably nearly 1,000. We had a large group, but we also got, that was because we got the group from Uganda. When Idi Amin came in, they had to pull all the Peace Corps volunteers in Uganda out, and they brought them up to us, and we had them join our group, and then we were only there about another 6 months before we had to get all of our folks out. But we looked down our noses a little bit at the volunteers in Kenya. We thought they had a really soft job down there. We used to say we were going to go down to Nairobi and eat wimpy burgers. That's what they called hamburgers. We sort of put them down a little bit.
Right.
We thought we were really the rugged ones, and they were the wimps. But they never got pulled out. But the Uganda folks came up, and they told us some hairy stories about, when Idi Amin came in, and they were so glad to get out of there.
Do you remember any of those stories?
They were threatened by Idi's troops and thugs and all of that. It was just kind of a frightening thing.
And they were, the Peace Corps people were moved sort of en masse.
Yeah.
To Ethiopia.
Oh yeah. They just didn't feel they could provide security for them.
Okay.
So they got them up to us. And about 3 months later, we were told by the embassy, "Let us know where you are at all times because we may have to evacuate you." And that connection we did have. And they said, we don't know what's going to happen with this political situation here in Ethiopia, but we are concerned, and we need to know where all of you are. And the Peace Corps top brass there in Addis said, yes, that you will let the embassy know. And we did, and it didn't happen exactly while I was there. They were beginning to pull us out, and then Mengistu came in, and they had to pull everybody out.
Now, Mengistu's rise to power, I'm not 100% clear on this, but was that occasioned by the death of Haile Selassie?
No, he didn't die.
Oh, okay.
No, Mengistu staged a communist revolution and overthrew him, and he was put in jail. His sons and grandsons were killed. His daughters were not, and that was surprising to people who were from the outside who didn't know the story there.
Uh-huh.
But his sons, they were not as bad as Saddam's sons, but they were almost as worthless. His daughters were all social workers. They were amazing. One of them lived out in our little province out there, which was almost unheard of, and was really very helpful to us. And if we needed some supplies or if we needed to connect with some of the religious power structure out there or whatever it was to do our work, they were very helpful in facilitating that. This is a man who had awful sons and wonderful daughters. The daughters were jailed, but they were never killed, and they may still be living as far as I know.
Did you meet the...
I met one of them. Yeah, Djazmach Kasyas. The Djazmach was the equivalent of mayor or provincial governor or whatever. That was their term for it.
Okay.
Kasa was the son of Haile Selassie's son-in-law, and it was his wife who was Haile Selassie's daughter.
Uh-huh.
I think her name was Miriam. And she was wonderful. And she was, she didn't flaunt her connections or her wealth or any of that. She really had this social worker's perspective. And we were all astonished to how this one man and his wife could produce such awful sons and great daughters, but that's the way it was.
Did you have any idea of what her background was? Had she gone to school overseas, Britain or somewhere?
It seems to me that she did. Most of them did, and Britain was where they went.
Mm-hmm.
So she probably did. I don't honestly remember.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
And under what circs did you meet her?
When I got out there, there were a number of hospitals and clinics out there. The Norwegians had one. And I think the Swedes had one too, and we were sort of living in their area there, and they had the connection already. There was a Norwegian doctor out there, a Swedish doctor. They were not Peace Corps. They were part of a Swedish group to work
mm-hmm.
in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the ones who brought us in and introduced us, me and my colleagues out there.
Wow.
And,
so the medical and social workers in these areas had connections, had networks.
That's right,
around.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we did.
And, Mike, did you leave before the actual coup?
Yeah, they pretty well said, you know, we're going to have to pull you out pretty soon, and it's going to get very, very hairy here, and you really need to be thinking about getting out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And Peace Corps pretty much said to us, if you want to leave, leave. That's okay. You've been here long enough. You've done good work. Pretty soon we're going to have to be pulled out. We don't want to have to go through a trauma like we had in Uganda. So let's begin to get a few people out at a time. And I had done a lot of training with not with the medical students, because I don't think they did very well. I mean, they were not very good. They were also elitist. But I did a lot of work with the people in the province itself and those who lived in the villages and so forth. And they pretty well knew how to immunize, how to find smallpox, identify it. They knew as much as I did. And I just pretty well gave them all the supplies I had and just said, I'm sorry, I have to go. And, you know, there were lots of hugs and tears and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I tried to get Otto Bulte, my language teacher, out and tried to get him into school
mm-hmm.
in the United States, because if I'd been able to do that, he would have been able to get a visa, and I could never get a school to take him. And I never heard what happened to him after the coup. I hope he did well, but I tried to get him into Arkansas A&M College, and they wrote back and said, well, you know, we don't have his transcript and all this kind of bureaucratic BS.
Sure. Sure. Uh-huh.
And so that just didn't happen.
It just didn't come together.
Yeah. So I hope he did well.
Now, Mike, you mentioned the medical students, and I just want to ask about that a little bit more.
Yeah.
These were men and women?
Both men and women, and Laura, it was astonishing. I had such a group of them. Some of them were Indian by heritage,
yes.
From the Indian subcontinent. And the Indians in Ethiopia, for whatever reason, from their perspective, had chosen not to become Ethiopian citizens and maintain their ties with the nation of India.
Uh-huh.
And they were looked down upon for that. Their perspective is that Ethiopia wouldn't let them become citizens. So when Idi Amin came into Uganda, he immediately declared that all the Indians had to leave. When Mengistu came into Ethiopia, he did the same thing, and even more brutally, and I think they really probably killed a lot of them. But a number of the students I had were Indian.
Okay.
A number were not. They were both Eritrean and
uh-huh.
Ethiopian, and that was a very, very different group. Ethiopia occupied Eritrea. Eritrea considered itself an independent country.
Yes.
One of my students was killed hijacking a plane for the Eritrean Liberation Front. Another was very, very strongly pro Ethiopia and had to get out of there and get into one of the neighboring countries, and I can't remember whether it was Somalia or the Sudan, but he had to get out of there. He got on the wrong side of one of the groups. And I'm trying to teach these kids how to work with native healers in the Kempwalega province, and they're hijacking planes and getting involved in all the other stuff and wondering if they're still going to be citizens after the government changes. It was hard to get their attention, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
But the main problem I had with them was that they were so elitist, they couldn't. You know, they didn't want to get off the bus when we got out there. Where are we going to live? Are these untouchable, unclean people, they're not the kind of people we're used to working with, and so forth. And I thought, man, you guys have a problem.
Did the government of Ethiopia put them in the position where they were supposed to be out in the provinces?
Yes.
Or?
It was with the World Health Organization.
I see.
Did
okay.
a lot of that. Uh-huh. And WHO worked a lot with Peace Corps and joint programs and so forth. In fact, my boss was a Chinese doctor, I think from Taiwan, who was with the World Health Organization in Ethiopia and was part of the Haile Selassie the First University Medical School. So they had the medical school there. WHO funded a lot of their programs. Peace Corps sort of worked with them, and it all was sort of interacting there.
Uh-huh.
There was a lot of interaction and a lot of interchange, and that worked out fine. WHO did some great stuff out there. I mean, they were the ones who really organized the anti-smallpox campaign, and
right.
Peace Corps brought the staff in to do the work.
Right.
But it was their organization, and They were just great there.
But the medical students were...
They were part of the university, and how they got to be medical students, I was never quite clear, but they all seemed to be of a certain middle to higher middle to upper class from there.
And their heads were really connected to the politics
Addison. Oh, yeah. And they were all walking around with Mao's little red book. That was astonishing.
Were they really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. They all had the little red book, and it was... They all had pictures of Mao, and they had T-shirts with Che on it and all of this. And I thought, okay, how do you connect your passion for the people, quote-unquote, with this elitist attitude that you have for the people when you get out there to take care of them?
That's really interesting. Very interesting.
Duh, do you not see a little disconnect there? And
this is
exactly
the kind of thing Mao would have hated.
Yeah, right, right.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's really quite fascinating. Do you know anything else, or do you recall anything else about the links between this, one or two of the students and the Eritrean?
No, I just remember the one woman who was one of the most passionate of all of them, and really sort of kept herself apart. I guess it was a bit like Sunni Shia. I mean, they may have been from the same part of the world, but they were very, very different in their outlooks.
Right.
And yeah, she and some of her group, apparently the Eritrean Liberation Front, had a big cell in Addis, and she was part of that. And next thing you know, she wasn't coming, and I said, why? And they said, well, this is why. The other students told me what she had done, and they had tried to hijack a plane. I'm not sure where they were going or what they were doing with it, but that's what happened. And then all of a sudden, another one of the students, who was Ethiopian, not Eritrean, didn't show up, and they said, oh, yeah, he had to leave the country. He had to. Either went to Somalia or the Sudan, one of them.
And this woman that was involved in the hijacking, do you know whether she survived that or
no, she was killed.
About it? She was killed.
No, that's what they told me. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, of course, if we think back, hijacking in the early 1970s and mid 70s, that was sort of flavor of the month.
Yes, it was.
It was. It happened with great frequency
it
during
did.
That time period, and especially
and I didn't
in
ask,
North Africa.
I didn't ask what plane she was hijacking, or where she planned to go. I just
right.
I heard the words, and I said,
okay.
I'm sorry about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Mike, did you have a hard time leaving Ethiopia?
Yeah, yeah. I felt in a way I was letting them down. I think what made it easier was the experience that we had all had with the Ugandans. When they came up and told us what they had gone through, and I got the picture then. Okay, this is what happens when a brutal government takes over, you don't want to be there, and so that made it easier, I think.
Mm-hmm.
If I had not had that experience with them, I think it would have been harder to leave.
You might have lingered longer.
I might have stayed longer. But pretty quickly the government said, you got to get out of here. We can't protect you.
And what was your next step?
My next step was to go back, and I went back to the city. I didn't go back to the County of Los Angeles Mental Health Center. I went back to the City of Long Beach Mental Health Center. And Long Beach was one of the few cities in California that had its independent mental health center.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back and ran the drug and alcohol program for them for about 6 months. And the health officer retired. The public health officer, and they said, you know, you're doing a good job at that. We'd like to promote you up to run the whole health department. And I said, fine. I was a little concerned that my being gay might be an issue. I wasn't out to the officially to the city government in Long Beach. Unofficially, my boss at the drug and alcohol program certainly knew and was very supportive, and they all were, and they really said, gee, we really want you to do this, and you've got a lot of ties and support in the community from your work with the City of Long Beach Mental Health Center.
Mm-hmm.
Do it. And I did, and it was a very good job in a way. I thought I did a good job. I think I did a good job. I did have a letter sent to the mayor saying I was gay and they should get me out by a disgruntled staff member I had to fire. But nothing happened with that at
nothing
all.
Nothing came of it?
Nothing came of that at all.
How did you
the mayor
out?
Just mayor sent it to me and said, I just wanted you to know I got this, and that was that.
So
and
was
nothing ever happened. I mean, this guy was really destructive and an awful man, and I think they knew that and didn't pursue it.
He didn't have much credibility then?
No.
But
after a while, I decided public health is great, but I'm in mental health, not public health, and I want to do something different. So that's when I went up to the City of Berkeley and ran their mental health department.
And the previous one that you were head of the health health department, that was City of Long Beach?
City of Long Beach,
okay.
Yeah.
And then at what point did you go up to Berkeley?
73.
Okay.
In 73. I had come back from Peace Corps early in, let's see, in 73. It must have been 74 because I had only been in Peace Corps 72 and part of 73. I ran the City of Long Beach Health Department for about a year, so it must have been late 74.
74?
Yeah, and I was up there 74, I think,
okay.
75.
And you were the head of the City of
Berkeley? Head of the City of Berkeley Mental Health Department.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what was the situation in Berkeley? Can you convey?
Worst job I ever had.
Okay.
Worst job I ever had. And probably the most racist city manager I ever worked for.
Really?
Yeah. He was African-American who was busily ripping off the low-income African-Americans in Berkeley by going down and buying their homes at virtually no cost and bumping them out and then, you know, proclaiming himself as the great savior of the African-American people in Berkeley and all that. And for some reason, the mayor just didn't get the hint and what he was doing, and he also was extremely hard on white staffers, and just a really tough guy to work for.
Was the mayor in some way intimidated because of the political climate?
Probably. The mayor was African American himself and a very good guy, but for some reason Elijah Rogers was able to, you know, just, I don't know what he had on the mayor. Maybe he had something on him. I don't know. All I know is that he was really tough to work for, and I only did that about a year, and then I went over to San Mateo County and ran that program for a couple of years.
How long?
I think 2 years, and then I went to Arkansas to work for Clinton in 78. Yeah.
Okay. Let me just ask you about a couple of events in that timeline, Mike.
Okay.
I'm thinking particularly about the Paris Peace Accords and the release of the long-held American POWs. Do you recall that?
I remember it, and I remember being very happy that it happened, but I remember being just profoundly saddened and outraged by the fact that Nixon, coming in so-called with a plan, had managed to keep the war going another couple years and getting as many killed on his watch as were killed before, and there was no plan. There were rumors that, of all things, I'm sure you've heard this, through Madame Chiang Kai-shek's connections, they had told the guy in Kalkee to, or Kissinger had to, you know, delay, and to delay in your negotiations in Paris, because when the Nixon group comes in, we will give you a better deal.
Right.
We heard all of that stuff, and I don't know whether it's true or not. I believed it at the time. I probably still do. But that's what I mostly remember. Yeah, and then I was glad when the war was over, and I was glad when the prisoners all came home, and I thought, well, maybe, just maybe this will end. And,
had you paid much attention, although you were in Ethiopia, to the Nixon re-election and the run against McGovern?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Did you find McGovern to be a viable candidate?
I didn't think he had a chance, and I didn't think he had a clue to win. Nobody even knew he was in the war. I mean, he didn't even talk about that.
Right, in World War II.
World War II. Nobody talked about
that. He was, what, in B-17s or something?
Yeah.
He
certainly had that he could have used, but I didn't think he had a chance. I thought it was a sure thing he was going to lose, and I thought that was very sad, but there you were. I mean,
right.
This was before Watergate.
Yes.
I remember going to the first McGovern rally in Los Angeles and thinking, this man sounds like Liberace. He is not, no way is he going to get America to go for him. And,
Mike, what do you mean by that?
I mean his voice.
He
really sounded like Liberace.
Uh-huh. He just wasn't a powerful public speaker.
Oh, it wasn't just that. I mean, he sounded effeminate.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
He really did. And my partner was with me at the time, and I turned to him, and I said, what do you think? And he said, he ain't going to get Middle America. And I said, does he remind you of anyone? And he said, no, I don't think so. And I said, think Liberace. And he said, ah, yes.
That's really good.
Yeah.
I've never thought that before. That's quite good.
That is what he sounded like to me. I had been for Gene McCarthy in the past. I'd been for Robert Kennedy, all those. None of that went anywhere.
Right.
And, okay, McGovern. I'll take McGovern. I'll take anybody over Nixon.
Did you hope, for example, that Kennedy might, this would be Ted Kennedy, might come to the fore in 72?
I did. Yeah, and that
despite,
was before Chappaquiddick.
Yeah,
and,
despite that.
I actually had a very brief afternoon in Vietnam when I was the doctor for Kennedy. He came over to visit the troops and all that, and he came into our ship, and I was on the ship, and he had I think he'd had a plane, had been in a plane crash and had a back injury,
mm-hmm.
and the people with him just said, we need to know who the doctor is here, and in case he needs some help or something. And so I met him and introduced myself and told him that I had been on the J.P. Kennedy Jr. and ship in Newport, and we chatted a little bit about that, and he said, you know, do you have a wife at home? And I said, yes. And he said, would you like me to write her a letter? And I said, sure. So I gave him the address, and he did. He wrote a very nice letter to her, just said, I met your husband, and he was the physician on the ship, and I really appreciated having him around and so forth. So that was my little connection with Ted Kennedy. But
Can I just stop you there, Mike?
Yeah.
And ask, which ship were you on when this happened?
That was on the Eversole, I think.
Okay.
USS Eversole. It was either the Eversole or the Brenner. Brenner, but I think it was the Eversole.
Uh-huh. And that initiative that he took to write the letter, did that surprise you?
No. It only surprised me in this way. He was doing that for... He said, are there any sailors here from Massachusetts? And there were a lot of them were, and one of his staffers took down all the names.
Got it.
And all the addresses, and he did that as a matter of course.
Mm-hmm.
And it only surprised me in that I was not from Massachusetts. So he was thoughtful enough to do that just because I happened to be the doc on board. I obviously didn't offer any medical care.
Sure.
But I was there in case he needed me, and he was nice enough to do that, and I appreciated that.
And what was your impression of him? You know, you get an impression, you look in someone's eye, and you shake their hand. What was your impression
of
him?
I liked him. He didn't give me the politician stare.
Really?
When he was meeting with me, he was talking to me
uh-huh.
and engaged in conversation with me. He was not looking around me to see who is more important than I can be talking to. And I've met politicians who've done one and met politicians who've done the other, and I can tell the difference. And he was right with me. I mean, we must have spoken 5 minutes at the most.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a picture of that. I had some folks take pictures of it, and they gave me pictures of it, and I was wearing some awful, awful glasses at the time. It was awful frames, and when I showed it back home, they said, you should have taken off your glasses. And I said, I couldn't see him without my glasses.
You didn't realize this was a fashion moment.
No, I didn't. I didn't.
Well, how does Ted look in the
Ted
picture?
Ted looked great. Oh,
okay.
He looked terrific. Yeah, he was a very handsome man those days.
Absolutely. And he's a very good-looking man now.
Yes, he is. Yeah. He needs to get the weight off.
But he's doing better with that, I think. He's remarried. And
I think he's
helped.
Helping him with
yes,
that.
Yes, I agree. I think so, too. He seems healthier.
Yeah.
And you had some hope then around his
oh, yeah,
making
yeah,
force.
Oh yeah, I did. And then I just don't remember what was going on with me at the time was
mm-hmm.
dealing with these problems with Ray, my partner.
Sure, absolutely.
Going to Peace Corps and all that. And you know, the part of me thinks maybe I just needed to get out of the country because Nixon was going to be reelected too. I couldn't stand the thought, and I just wanted to get away from there.
And was also going to Ethiopia part of your own sort of
my own healing.
Yeah, heck,
healing's
a word for from Vietnam and
yes,
the
absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely, and I think going into community mental health was part of that. You know, I needed to do something like that. I didn't want to go in private practice and all of that.
Now, Mike, if I can just ask you a little bit about 1978, you
okay.
said that you went back to Arkansas.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I was mental health chief in San Mateo County and.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny how these things happen. I had an assistant who was really not doing a very good job and was really bad, and everybody kind of disliked him, and I was struggling with whether I had to demote him or fire him or whatever. Well, he found an announcement in one of the medical or mental health papers that said they were looking for a commissioner of mental health in Arkansas. He knew I was from Arkansas. So he put it on my desk, and I have always thought he did that hoping I'd leave so he would be able to stay there. And
subtle.
It worked. I got in touch with him, and I thought someone told me, you know, they've got this very bright governor back there named David Pryor who's likely to go up to the Senate,
mm-hmm.
and they have this very well-educated Yaley named Bill Clinton who is the attorney general now, who's likely to go up and be governor, and he's put the word out. He wants to bring people who used to be in Arkansas back to the state to do what needs to be done. So that sort of was intriguing, and I talked to the people who were chair of the mental health board back there, and she came out to California for something and said, "Can I meet with you when I'm out there?" And
mm-hmm.
I took her to a nice restaurant, and we had a nice lunch, and she said, we really would like to get you back. So I went back to be interviewed. And when I was, I don't know how much you're interested in this. My
Very
interview with Clinton or any of that.
Very
okay, I went back. David Pryor was the governor.
Yes.
And David was the person I first had to interview with. And he was about, this must have been July or August, because he was going to go up as senator and Clinton was coming in as governor. And he was someone whose my family had known for a while. I had vaguely known him at college, but not really. But he said, you know, I think you'd be good here, but I can't hire you because I'm going to not be in this position. I want you to go over and meet with Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
And have I not told you this story?
No.
Okay.
This is another of your brushes with greatness,
oh,
Mike.
Wow, wow,
you
wow.
hide from the world, but
yeah, well,
this is the time.
You know, you're controlling this interview. You tell me when I'm not interested in that.
This is fascinating. Please
okay.
go ahead. I mean, this
all
this
right,
will
so
be great.
I go over to meet with Bill.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, David is really a very handsome guy.
Uh-huh.
And David Pryor, and he interviews me in the governor's mansion, and he's sitting on this couch, and he says, come over and sit down. And I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking, uh-oh, you better control yourself.
Yeah, something's happening.
Yeah, and he hands me these jelly beans, I remember, and he said, would you like some jelly beans? And I was beginning to feel like I was being seduced by this guy. And not just for the mental health thing. Fortunately, and I'm sure he's straight,
funny.
And it was just Southernism in him.
Right.
Next thing you know, after we finish talking, his wife comes down from upstairs, mm-hmm. and he introduces me to her, and all of this moment has passed, fortunately.
Uh-huh.
But he sends me over to meet with Bill. And I went over and met with Clinton, and we, Attorney General's office, and we chatted for a bit, and we were pretty clear. We were on the same wavelength about what Arkansas needed for mental health and so forth. And then we talked about jazz, and we talked about Arkansas football and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I think you'd be a good fit back here. I'd like working with you. I'd like to offer you the job. And I said to myself, self, you've been out of the closet for a long time, and you're not about to go back in.
Mm-hmm.
And you better get this clarified before you even think about coming back to Arkansas and working for this guy.
Mm-hmm.
So I said to him, I think it's Bill or General or whatever I called him, I said, I would really like to come back here, and I think you're right. I think we would work well together, but I got to let you know I'm gay. And he said, okay. And I said, oh, yeah, great. This guy's been to Yale. He's been to Oxford and all that. He doesn't have a clue what I'm talking about. And I said, Mr. Clinton, I'm gay. I'm homosexual. And he said, well, I kind of figured if you were gay, you were also homosexual.
Did he really say that?
Yeah, I said that. And I said, well, does that bother you? And he said, yeah, a whole lot, about as much as the fact that you got brown hair and 2 feet. He said, look, let me tell you something. I expect the same standards from you I expect from anyone else in the cabinet. And if the legislature ever gives you a hard time, anyone in the legislature, let me know. I'll get them off your back. And so I took the job. I mean, and it turned out that several members of his cabinet were gay or lesbian, and that really was not an issue for him at all. Much later, when it came up, when he became president and the Don't Ask, Don't Tell stuff came in, I always thought one of the reasons he was so naive about that is because he was so personally free of prejudice. Saying gays and lesbians couldn't serve in the military to him sounded like people of Finnish extraction couldn't serve in the military. It was kind of a, huh? Why?
He just couldn't imagine.
He couldn't imagine it.
Having a problem.
And he and Hillary both had. In fact, his assistant attorney general was, I thought, probably his best friend who was openly gay.
Who was that?
That was Kirby Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that carrying the story forward with
mm-hmm.
Kirby, years later, after 2 years, he was voted out, and I went back to Arkansas. Clinton was, but
yes.
Then he came back in. But Kirby got sick with AIDS in, I've forgotten when it was. It must have been 82 or 83 or so. And I asked, Kirby had come out to San Francisco. He and I became very, very good friends when I was there as mental health commissioner. And he came out to San Francisco for the Democratic convention, I think, in 84.
Mm-hmm.
And we just had a great time at the convention. He got me into all the meetings, and I introduced my then partner to Clinton at the Arkansas reception and all of that. And he, you know, again, he said, gee, Mike, you know, it's great to see you again and all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And then Kirby and I went out and had dinner after the whole thing was over, and that's when he told me he was positive. About a year later, he was not doing well, and I said, Kirby, I really want you to move out to San Francisco. I'll get you hooked up with the best doctors out here. You can live with me and all that. He said, I don't need to do that. In fact, people from Dallas are coming over to get treatment in Little Rock. Clinton has made darn sure that we have a good HIV treatment program here in Little Rock. And I said, you mean personally? And he said, absolutely. Kirby died. When Kirby, before he died, Clinton was one of his the people who brought him soup and brought him, you know, food and checked on him and all of that. And I don't mean sending someone to do it. I mean, he personally came over and did it.
About when did Kirby actually pass away?
I think he died in either 85 or 86.
Mm-hmm.
And Clinton gave the eulogy at the church and for Kirby. And he said, I want you to know two things. First of all, this was a man who was my good friend, and I loved him very much. And second of all, I will not hear of any prejudice in this state, if I can help it, against people who are HIV positive or people who are gay or lesbian. And
wow.
Just laid that right out there. Now, when he was running for president in 92, I was able to share those experiences and that knowledge with the gay community in San Francisco. And I was very active with the Northern California branch of the Clinton Gore campaign, and they had me talking to the gays, the Jews, the veterans, and the docs. And that was one of the things I talked to the gay groups about. And so Clinton was terrific on that.
Now, if I can just follow up a little bit.
Yeah.
Clinton was Attorney General when you interviewed with him.
That's correct.
But he was,
but
of
he
course,
became, I interviewed with him in August, and he became governor in January.
Okay, and the election was imminent.
That's right. The election the election was imminent. I remember being in the campaign headquarters when they actually had the election, which must have been November.
Okay.
But I interviewed with him in August, and there was nominal opposition, so there was
yes.
no question about
uh-huh.
his going up.
And the position that you eventually took with the state was chair of the mental health commission?
No, commissioner of mental health.
Commissioner of mental
yeah.
health. Okay. And did you at any time have an opportunity to meet Hillary?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. She was doing a lot of work with children's programs, children's mental health. I don't know whether you know this about Hillary or not, but the great contemporary seminal work on child psychiatry by Sonnet and Anna Freud was written at Yale. Marv Sonnet was the chair of child psychiatry at Yale Medical School,
mm-hmm.
and Anna Freud worked with him on Beyond the Best Interests of the Child.
Mm-hmm.
Hillary, as a law student, did a lot of the legal research for them. She was one of their assistants who worked with them on the legal stuff as a law student at Yale. And so she knew these issues, and she was working a lot with child mental health programs in Arkansas. And so I met her in that capacity and had just the greatest respect for her.
Now, was she in private practice at that point?
I think so.
But
I think so, but she may not have been. I'm not quite sure.
Okay.
This was his first term, and
yes.
she may just have been doing only volunteer stuff then, but I think she went into practice after the second term.
What impression did you form of her
at
that point?
Extremely bright,
yes.
extremely nice.
Okay.
Wondered if she might be lesbian because she had very close friends who were from New York, whom she had encouraged to come down, women to run such programs as the prison system,
mm-hmm.
The public health system, and the Ozark Commission. And the woman who was with the Ozark Commission was wonderful. I just adored her. She was terrific. She had a lot of background in state parks and national parks and all of that, and that's what the Ozark Commission was supposed to do. To
what
protect
was her name?
I cannot remember.
Okay.
I wish I could, but
that's
I can't.
Okay. That's okay. It can be fun.
But I remember thinking this woman would make Gertrude Stein look, you know, like
frilly and fun,
a film or something.
Yeah, right.
She was very direct
and
very good, and a joy to be with. She and I shared a love of two things: Thai food and chamber music, and in addition to the forest. So
mm-hmm.
we'd get on the phone and talk about all that sort of stuff. I just thought she was wonderful. I wish I could remember her name, but I can't.
That's
but
okay.
She was a very, very close friend of Hillary's in Yale, and I thought,
uh-huh.
So what really it was, I think, was Hillary was like Bill. She was so comfortable with gay and lesbian people that, you know, if they had something to offer her, their homosexuality was irrelevant. In
and
any
did Hillary ever speak to you about, did you ever have a sort of one-on-one conversation with her, either at a meeting or at
only
a
about health
or,
stuff, yeah, only
yeah.
about health stuff.
And she was clearly then supportive of the kinds of things that you were
oh, yeah.
trying to do.
Absolutely.
Wow. Have you met her subsequently? I'm sure you must have.
Yeah, I was on the President's Advisory Council on HIV and AIDS, and anytime we would meet with the President at the White House, which is where we usually met with him,
mm-hmm.
The cabinet room or something, she was often there, and we would get a chance to chat a bit. And I did chat with her during the 92 campaign, too, because she would come out to California to speak, and I would always meet with her then. Not so much one-on-one, but with groups.
Thinking back on this during the 90s, it must have been almost surreal for you to sort of see them, you know, as president and first lady.
Yeah, I remember the first time he came to speak in California, Northern California, after he had been elected, those of us who were active in the campaign got a chance to meet with him in a smaller group, and he was coming around talking to us. And I said to him, "Mr. President, the thing I most regret at this moment is that Kirby Smith is not here to see it." And he said, "So do I." He said, "I miss Kirby very much." And that was a sort of personal moment there that he and I shared.
Yes, absolutely. Mike, can you tell me a little bit about the policy problems that were in front of you as the commissioner?
Well, I could not have had a more supportive governor, that's for darn sure.
I guess.
But the issues that we had to deal with were that the system was very unclear in terms of who reported to whom. All the counties, or at least most of the counties, or most of the regions within the state, had their own mental health centers, and they had their own boards. Mm-hmm. And we in the state were funding them. But the directors of these mental health centers did not report to me. They reported to their boards. The state legislature said to me, "We want you to make sure that these community mental health centers are doing the right thing, are doing what the people need in the community, and that they're spending the money the way we want them to." Well, that was fine, but when I would go out and meet with a community mental health center staff or board or something, and they were not doing that, then I had very little authority to change it.
Right. What could you do?
I could not fire the directors. I could not even get them to change very much, although most of them were very good. There were only two or three that were really problematic. But if I tried to make a change, you know, they would go to their boards, and their boards were local, and they had their own power structure there, and they would counter me. And so there were two or three I think really should have been fired or changed or something, and the whole program shift. Done, and I wasn't able to accomplish that. But the most of the people I worked with were very good. There was another problem in that in some of the programs I was in charge. I did have full authority over the state hospital and mm-hmm. the state and in Benton, the long-term care facility. There were some staff there who had gotten on the outs with some of the local legislators, and the local legislators called me aside and said, "I want you to fire Charlie or John or Bill mm-hmm. or whoever it was." Mm-hmm. And I happen to know that Charlie, John, or Bill were all doing excellent work, and they just had said something untoward toward a legislator, probably because the legislator had sent some total incompetent, his cousin or something, and our supporter over to be hired, and they didn't want to hire him.
Sure.
It was
right.
That kind of thing.
I see.
And there were times when I really could not I would not fire Charlie, John, or Bill, but I would have to find a different job for him. And that was not good. And, you know, the governor pretty well said to me, Bill said, pretty well said to me, "You handle it. That's what I hired you for." And there were only rare times that I really had to go to him and said, you know, "This is wrong." But the legislators, they pretty well liked me. I know at least a couple of them knew I was gay because one came on to me. But that was a different situation. But it was a good job. I really liked it. I would have stayed longer if he hadn't gotten voted out.
And when he was turned out of office,
which was 1980,
yes,
end of 79, yeah,
right. That was part of the big sweep against Democrats nationally.
Well, it was, but then there was another. There were two other issues
okay.
in Arkansas. One was that was the time of the Mary Alistas, and when they came over, Castro just, you know, emptied his prisons, emptied his mental hospitals, and sent a lot of these very problematic people. And Carter didn't know what to do with them, so he said to Clinton, "Do you have any place you can put them?" And Clinton said, "Look, Fort Chaffee, our army base here, is pretty well empty now. We have barracks. They're all in good shape. We'll put them there until we decide what to do with them and process them through." Well, they rioted and burned the whole thing down. And the state of Arkansas said that made Clinton look like a chump, that Carter had just they were mad at Carter anyway.
Yes.
And that just made Clinton look like a wuss. For Carter.
Carter. Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is Clinton had the nerve to raise the fishing license, I think, from $5 to $6 a year.
That was a big issue.
Arkansas was not amused.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So that was the other issue, but it was, I think, more the Fort Chaffee thing than anything else. And they elected this Republican, poor guy, who announced right after in his inaugural that he was going to go to Japan and other places in the Middle East to find business for Arkansas.
I heard you say business there.
That's what he said, and they had a picture, an editorial cartoon in the paper the next day of him going in a rickshaw through the sands of Saudi Arabia looking for business. Oh, poor guy. He didn't last long.
No, he didn't.
He didn't. Out he went in 2 years, and then Clinton came back in.
When you learned that Clinton had been defeated, did that make clear to you that you could not stay in the position that you
had? Oh, yeah. This guy announced that he wanted Christian Republicans in his cabinet. And
okay.
not being either one, I thought this is not a good sign.
Right. What did you think you might do next?
I wasn't sure, but I'll tell you, at the time, it was fortuitous because I was beginning to hear the horror stories of how veterans were being treated, our people were being treated in the VAs. And I thought, okay, it's time to go back. And so I went to the VA in San Francisco, and I had a friend who worked there, and I said, I need a job, and I need to work with these vets, and I was there for the next 18 years. Not in San Francisco, but I was at the VA for the next 18 years.
Now, did you go directly then to San Francisco?
Yeah,
okay.
I did.
And was that transition a fairly easy one? Or
yeah, I had a home in San Francisco. I had rented out while I was gone, the 2 years while I was gone, while I decided whether I was going to stay in Arkansas or not. So I had a house to go back to. My sister and her family lived back there.
I
had obviously a lot of friends.
Sure.
And, so that part of it was an easy transition.
What horror stories had you begun to hear? Can you give me the flavor of that?
Yeah, veterans being badly mistreated, not accepted for care, their post-traumatic stress being ignored, being given misdiagnoses, being told they were baby killers, all of that stuff. And, I mean, I couldn't believe people working at a VA would be saying things like that. And I heard some of it in Little Rock, at the Little Rock VA. The head of the VA there was kind of a jerk. And he was, he was always trying to recruit me for the VA there. And I thought, man, I would never work for this guy anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But then I began to, I did go over and do some consulting with him a little bit. And just kind of a freebie.
Yeah.
And I began to hear this and see this.
Uh-huh.
And then I began to read about some of it in the papers. The papers were talking about it. I think the VBA by that time had their own newsletter, and they were writing about it. It was beginning to be widely known. I think there was, there may have been something that came out in the movies about that time about it. I don't know whether Coming Home was out then. The one, I think, where the paraplegic came and had a loving affair with an actress. I've forgotten who that was.
I'm sorry, I don't remember that one either.
Yeah, I don't remember that one either. That was one of them, though. It was about that time that a movie came out from Hollywood that showed a very badly treated veteran. And I think the Deer Hunter came out about that time.
79, uh-huh.
Yeah, 79. And so all of that was right in my consciousness. And I decided I did not want to go back to San Mateo County. I did not want to go back to Berkeley, certainly. And the VA had an opening, and that was a good fit. So I went back there.
And at that point, did you think that the problems with the what you were hearing about were remediated? They could be addressed rather than
they could be addressed because a lot of the veterans were coming back to work in VA hospitals, the docs, the nurses, the corpsmen, and all of that. And Menlo Park had just begun to develop its big PTSD program, and for Vietnam vets, and that was beginning to get some prominence, I think. We had no sense at all. Reagan was president he became president in 80, I guess.
Yeah, he was elected.
And by that time, we got no sense that there was any awareness of this on a national level at all.
Right.
That certainly never changed. Mm-hmm. But in various VA hospitals, it was very much the same when AIDS hit. There were those who had the experience, who knew the people and could develop the programs and had the commitment and the passion about it and develop the programs, and that's
right.
What happened.
Right, and I'll be, if you agree to it, asking you about that
sure.
Next time. But let's take a break for today.
Okay.